Juste ça alors, yes, had you got any questions? Has everyone, did everyone answer the questions? Everyone read the pages? I must admit, you know, last week, because I had a little internet trouble at home, so I got the questions up a little late. During the course of the class, if there are any questions that you looked at, you felt that you had difficulty, then, you know, make sure you address it during the class, and we can make sure that you should do that in every class to make sure that by the time you leave the class, for whatever homework that we've set is somehow you haven't been able to do it or had difficulty with it, you know, you finish it. Because most of those things will be in the test, so it's sort of not the sort of, they're the essence, so they're not the sort of thing you want to just let go. So we'll, as we go through anyway, we'll pick up, you know, what the answers were, what they should have been. Who was that who asked me a question last week? I think she's here. There's another lady that's usually here. What's her name? No, there's another one. Is that it? Padma? She's coming. And Ursula. One of the ladies asked me a question right at the end of last week's, after we finished, which is actually, when I thought about it later, I gave an answer, but I thought about it. It was a really good question, because her question was, Arjun was considering that he didn't want to destroy dynasty and thereby destroy religious principles. And she asked me the question that if that were the case, why would he then let Duryodhana rule? Right? Because, you know, that would then, because they're not passing down traditions. So by allowing Duryodhana to rule and Arjuna not fighting, he's actually getting the result that he's afraid of. You see what I mean? Because Arjuna's saying that he's afraid that religious traditions will be lost, and therefore I won't fight. But actually, by not fighting, he's allowing Duryodhana to rule, and Duryodhana is not passing down religious traditions properly by his example, right? Because they're, you know, passing down a new non-Vedic tradition, of, you know, based on greed and envy, like that. So my answer to her was that, in one sense, Arjun certainly didn't want to do anything worse than what Duryodhana was doing. And as we discussed today, by killing gurus, so, you know, Duryodhana was doing a lot of sinful activity, there's no doubt. He was trying to kill off some pious people, but by killing his gurus, he was really escalating the non, you know, that's like the ultimate non-Vedic thing to do. So, in one sense, he certainly didn't want to be party in it himself, or to escalate it. But the other reason I gave, which is actually really the theme of today's talk, is that Arjun's whole way of thinking had actually been slightly contaminated. Contaminated by a bodily conception of life, you know, a non-Aryan, you know, the Aryan, or, you know, the Vedic conception of life is based upon the spirit soul. But his, Arjun, was considerations, moral, religious, you know, logical, which have been contaminated by a material concept of life. And therefore, part of the answer to her question was that Arjuna was making arguments which were actually not quite correct, and that they were a bit artificial and a bit false, but he was almost justifying what he wanted to happen. So it was a very intelligent question. It's actually one of the most intelligent questions that I've been asked on the Bhagavad Gita, which was really interesting considering that last week's topic we were discussing how people misuse the quote that Chanakya Pandit says that never trust a woman because she's unintelligent. See my point? So it was just interesting that one of the so the men have to sort of pull up the socks there, because as you can see, that was a very, very, very good question. Really underpinned, the whole section that we're doing, and it sort of was a living example of what we were saying. That actually, on the spiritual platform, you cannot sort of make material judgments based on someone's body, the body of the body. That you are male, you are female, you are black, you are white, you are young, you are old, like this, right? So it was, the more I thought about it, was Krishna was revealing that point in his living, in the living example. So the men have to pull their socks up a bit. So anyway, but that does bring us to the theme today of, at this point, Arjuna is, he's been presenting all these various arguments to Krishna, and at this point in the Bhagavad Gita, in the scene at Kurukshetra, in the midst of all the armies, Arjuna has put down his bow and said that he will not fight. at this point, Krishna basically chastises Arjuna a little bit, insults him a little bit to sort of, get that fighting spirit into Arjuna. And Arjuna then counters what Krishna has said to him by saying, "Oh no, I'm not having some, difficulty. I'm not, about to, neglect my duty because I'm a coward or because I'm weak or anything like that. No, I'm considering, so many, very important things. The gurus. We can't, insult gurus, let alone kill them. We should be compassionate to people who are foolish and ignorant. And so many different reasons like that." And ultimately, so we'll look at it more in depth, but what happens, of course, is then Arjuna realizes himself, well, my arguments just don't seem to be making sense, and I can see that, and I really don't know what I should be doing, like I've come up with all this, high philosophy, and at the end of it, I haven't got a clue what I'm supposed to do. So then, at that point, he actually surrenders to Krishna. And then that takes us to the end of this section, where Krishna is then about to deliver his instructions. And of course, as we shall always remember, Arjuna is Krishna's eternal friend, and he is assisting Krishna. He's playing a role. Although in playing that role, Krishna is very, very expert that he creates these parts so wonderfully that, even personalities like Arjuna, they become completely absorbed in it. But it is by Krishna's arrangement, and the whole. This last this lesson that we give today is the last sort of step in setting the scene for Krishna delivering spiritual instructions to Arjuna, which is really the whole purpose why the whole battle, you know, this whole history has actually, you know, been arranged by Krishna. And this is how significant in Krishna's teachings. So much arrangement, there are millions of soldiers, so, you know, such a long history, all coming together just so Krishna could actually deliver to all mankind these spiritual instructions. That's what's really happening. Krishna has made all these arrangements. So we can look at this now in a little bit more depth, but that's the scenario of today's lesson here. So can someone just read today's the first verse?
Sanjaya said, "Seeing Arjuna full of compassion, his mind depressed, his eyes full of tears, Madhusudana Krishna spoke the following words. So for material compassion, lamentation and tears are all signs of ignorance of the real self. Compassion for the eternal soul is self-realization. The word Madhusudana is significant in this verse. Lord Krishna killed the demon Madhu, and now Arjuna wanted Krishna to kill the demon of misunderstanding that had overtaken him in the discharge of his duty. No one knows where compassion should be applied. Compassion for the death of a drowning man is senseless. A man falling in the ocean of nations cannot be saved simply by rescuing his outward death, the gross material body. One who does not know this and laments for the outward death is called a Shudra, or one who laments unnecessarily. Arjuna was a Kshatriya, and this conduct was not expected from him. Lord Krishna, however, can dissipate the lamentation of the ignorant man, and for this purpose the Bhagavad Gita was sung by him. This chapter instructs us in self-realization by an analytical study of the material body and the spirit soul, as explained by the Supreme Authority, Lord Sri Krishna. This realization is possible when one works without attachment to fruitive results and is situated in the fixed conception of the real self."
So, one point in there, of course, is that Krishna is actually gradually taking Arjuna through various different stages of yoga in order to gradually bring him to the point of bhakti yoga. So, Krishna takes Arjuna through successive processes which gradually purify, enlighten, and help one to understand bhakti yoga. So Krishna is not teaching that one should take up these other processes, Kama Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Astanga Yoga, like that. He's presenting them in the Bhagavad Gita, Kriya Yoga. You see so many people, I once read a book by Paramahansa Yogananda. Ever read that? The autobiography of a yogi? Yes, read that? Yeah. Anyone else read that? Yes. So in that, of course, you know, he mentions Kriya Yoga. And he says, you know, it's there in the Bhagavad Gita. So if you read his book, you think, oh, Bhagavad Gita is teaching Kriya Yoga. And, you know, there are so many books like that. And they'll say, oh, yes, there in the Bhagavad Gita. But the way they put it, you think, oh, Bhagavad Gita is teaching Jnana Yoga, it's teaching Kama Yoga, it's teaching this. Bhagavad Gita is not teaching anything else except Bhakti Yoga. Why are these things presented? Is because Krishna has to present them in comparison, in gradual steps, what is easier understood, and then a little bit more difficult understood, and then a little bit more difficult. Gradually, when one understands very close, then Krishna explains Bhakti Yoga, although he gives hints of it all the way through, like this. So, in this chapter, therefore, we touch upon, there's a lot on well, it touches on karma yoga, jnana yoga. You know, another term we can use for jnana yoga is sankhya yoga, and also buddhi yoga, which is Krishna consciousness or bhakti yoga. So, karma yoga in general, there's a karma kanda section of the Vedas. If someone is performing pious activities for one's own self, that's karma, it's karma kanda. If one is performing pious activities, that I am a businessman, I want to earn wealth, but I don't want to be sinful about it, so therefore I'll do it in relationship with the Lord. I offer some of the results of my activities. There's a little bit of detachment there. And that way it's karma yoga, because it's actually in relationship with the Supreme Lord, and one is gradually learning a little detachment, and that detachment and knowledge gradually elevates one to jnana yoga, where one has because of the purification of the heart from karma yoga, one can actually understand the nature of the material world, and therefore understand I should be a little bit detached from it. So it is an increase in detachment and knowledge, and therefore also should be also an increase in one's relationship with the Supreme. So that jnana yoga, or astanga yoga, sankhya yoga, is an analytical study of the difference between matter and spirit. So that is taken up in this chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And then gradually, in this chapter, Krishna introduces Arjuna to buddhi yoga, which is devotional service. Buddhi yoga specifically means that there is a direct communion with the Lord, because one is situated in bhakti yoga. So instead of like the jnanis, they're extraneously trying to develop knowledge, but the devotee, just in the course of serving the Lord, automatically the Lord reveals everything, and that through the heart, and through, you know, so that is buddhi yoga. So he's being directly inspired by the Lord. So it is a spontaneous acquisition of knowledge in the pursuit of one's devotional service. So that is discussed there. Now it's interesting here that Krishna addresses Arjuna as Madhusudan, because the name Madhusudan is Krishna actually killed in the form of Vishnu way back at the beginning of creation. He killed one demon named Madhu, and there was another demon named Kaitra. And they actually, when Brahma was dozing off for a little while, they stole Vedic knowledge from him, and Vishnu had to come and kill those demons. Some scriptures of Krishna is the region of Vishnu. So he's known as Madhusudan. There are other regions. So Arjuna is addressing him, Madhusudan, or Sanjaya is addressing him as Madhusudan. And because the indication here is that Arjuna, he's having to kill his, relatives, like that. But at certain stages where he addresses Krishna as Madhusudan, he's indicating, you didn't have to do this. You killed your enemies. That's fine. But you're asking me to do something different. You're asking me to kill, superior relatives like that. So therefore, and sometimes Sanjaya uses the term Madhusudan in the sense that Sanjaya, who is speaking to Dhritarashtra, he's indicating in this that you've got your hopes of winning this war, but don't get your hopes up, because the Lord, who is the killer of the demons, he will kill the demon in the form of illusion that has now taken over Arjuna. And therefore, very soon Arjuna will be, corrected, and he will, perform his duty. So, in this way, the term is used in those different ways. Actually, whenever the terms of Krishna are used, Madhusudan, Hrishikesh, Govinda, they have a particular significance in context with the devotee who's actually speaking them. They're not just, Krishna has unlimited names, we'll just pick one out of the hat. The devotee is in a particular mood and they're thinking of Krishna in a particular context, and therefore they're utilizing those particular names, which Krishna really enjoys, because it means that utilizing those names of Krishna indicates that the devotee is thinking of Krishna in a particular personal way. Right? you like names for people, and different types of names according to your personal relationship. You know, a young child may call their father, other people may call that person sir according to their relationship at work. You know, the wife may have some other name I won't mention. But people have different names, for people according to the personal relationship. So Krishna likes it, because when you're actually utilizing Krishna's names like that appropriately, he knows you're personally thinking about him, and he really enjoys that. That's a sign of love. So here also we have this very important point of compassion, and I think the analogy was given in that report. Can you read that analogy? Yes.
Compassion for the depth of a drowning man is simple.
Yes, yep.
A man falling in the ocean of nations cannot be saved simply by rescuing his outward death, the gross material body. One who does not know this and lament for the outward death is called a Shudra, or one who laments unnecessarily.
Yes. So, this again, these analogies as they come up, if you haven't created some sort of a portfolio, then do so. They're very, very handy. And also sometimes you actually ask these questions. What is the analogy used to describe misplaced compassion? And you use the analogy of trying to save the external clothing of a drowning man, like that. So put these analogies in your portfolio. There's about three in this chapter. We have to be a little quiet over there, please. So this theme of compassion, misplaced compassion, the self-realization, the definition of self-realization is that one has compassion for the soul. And for one who's in ignorance, their compassion is misplaced for the body, for the neglect of the soul. So it's not that we should neglect compassion for the body, but we shouldn't do it whilst neglecting the soul. If there's actually compassion for the soul, only then can there actually be real compassion on all levels. You know, if there's no compassion for the soul, it is not possible to actually have real compassion. It is artificial. It is artificial and it's misplaced. And it's very limited, and in many cases it causes trouble. It causes perplexities. Sometimes, sometimes you try and help someone because you help them, everyone else is upset. misplaced compassion can, it is a material thing, and everything material has a material reaction. And as Arjuna is pointing out, in the previous verses, that I'm trying to enjoy, do certain things, and I seem to be getting the opposite, of what I'm actually intending, like that. And that is the very nature of the material world, and which is discussed throughout this chapter, the perplexities of material existence. So have a think about that, because actually later on we're going to ask a few questions about that. So gather your thoughts, anything that comes up during the course of the class that you want to ask about that, or make some comments, jot them down, because we'll have a little discussion on that later on. So
So we can read text 2. Someone would like to read that.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, how have these impurities come upon you? They are not at all befitting a man who knows the value of life. They lead not to higher planets, but to infinite purpose. Krishna and the Supreme Personality of Godhead are identical. Therefore, Lord Krishna is referred to as Bhagwan throughout the Gita. Bhagwan is the ultimate in the absolute truth. The absolute truth is realized in three forms of understanding, namely Brahman or the impersonal all-pervasive spirit, Paramatma or the localized aspect of the Supreme within the heart of all living entities, and Bhagwan or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna."
Okay. Just read up to the end of the analogy of Bhagavan. Don't read the whole report.
In the Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.11, this conception of the absolute truth is explained as: the absolute truth is realized in three phases of understanding.
Now go on, keep going. Yes.
By the knower of the absolute truth, and all of them are identical. Such phases of the absolute truth are expressed as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan.
Can I continue?
No, that would be enough. That would be enough. Okay. That's a very long good book. Thank you for that. Here, Arjuna, sorry, Krishna, has expressed these, first of all, Krishna is quite surprised. You know, how this Arjuna, you wouldn't expect this from Arjuna, that from Krishna already understands he's bewildered, because Arjuna doesn't understand that, but Krishna can see one, the bewildered, there's this, even though Arjuna is actually coming from his mother was Kunti, who's also known as Prita, who was a sister of Krishna's father, Vasudeva. And Arjuna was actually born from Kunti and Indra. So Arjuna had a very illustrious birth. And he was coming in a Kshatriya family. And also, his friend was Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who was directly, guiding him there on the battle. So, Arjuna was also a very, very qualified Kshatriya. So, Krishna was quite surprised that, this sort, you imagine a warrior going into battle, and when they're on the verge of the battle, all of a sudden they come up for so many reasons, well, they just got to, take off for a little bit, so you might expect that among some of the rank and file, some of the, lesser Kshatriyas. Even then, it's not acceptable. But in the case of Arjuna, he is particularly surprising. That's what Krishna is saying, In your case, Arjuna, with your qualifications, your history, to see this in you, particularly. So that's Krishna is saying that. And he's actually chastising Arjuna. And, it's a bit insulting what he's saying. Krishna's actually, he's whipping him up for the battle, of course. But he's also instructing him, because it's a fact. There are three different terms that Krishna uses to, in one sense, describe Arjuna's compassion, so-called compassion. In this one, the word is Kajmalam, which means dirtiness or impurities.
that in the next verse, I'll just skip ahead a little bit, but he uses the term Shudram Hridaya Durbalyam, petty weakness of heart, and he also uses the term Klaidyam, impotence. So I'll just read the translation of the next verse as well, because we'll discuss them both together. That Krishna says, O son of Pritha, do not yield to this degrading impotence. It does not become you. Give up such petty weakness of heart and arise, O chastiser of the enemy. So, first of all, Krishna is pointing out, in a chastising way, because that is the role of the spiritual master. So Krishna is gradually, taking the mood of Arjuna's instructor. It's not official yet, but in this verse, that mood is gradually entering in. And, there's a saying, spare the rod, spoil the child. On the news the other night I heard that they just brought in a new legislation where a teacher who hit a student at school as a mild form of chastisement for being, carrying on, they took him to court and he got off. And of course, everyone is up in arms. How could he touch that child? It's a bit of a debate there. We shouldn't, hit children, but, sometimes some form of chastisement, here Krishna, verbally, that, there has to be some opportunity for, teachers, parents, preceptors to actually chastise those who are, taking instruction, if that need be there. Because if that is not there, if that is actually taken out, you cannot get the result. There is no way. Sometimes it has to be there. As I say, I'm not condoning, hitting children, but there has to be, some ability to chastise if it's done properly. Otherwise, even an adult, by a superior, even at work, that opportunity has to be there. Otherwise, we just have chaos. So Krishna did that. Krishna is known as being hard as a rose, hard as a thunderbolt, soft as a rose. Right? So, sometimes actually people may think God is very hard. And the fact is, he is hard. People always criticize. You hear that, oh God, how could God let this happen? They're saying, I can see that hard side that you have, Krishna. And he does. He's actually as hard as a thunderbolt. But he's also as soft as a rose. But it's not that people just think, oh, you're just hard. They don't see the soft side. He's simultaneous in the same way that even a teacher or a parent, when they're chastising a child, that's the last thing they want to do. The last thing they want to do is, upset the child, cause any sort of mental or, disturbance, in any way. But sometimes, in order to have a little bit of mental disturbance is better than the child having a huge, mental disturbance. Even Mother Yasoda chastised Krishna. Even Krishna accepted chastisement. He doesn't just dish it out, he sometimes receives it as well. So when he was a little baby, Mother Yasoda would take him around with a stick. So chastisement is there. And, when we should always understand, here we see that Krishna is chastising Arjuna, but ultimately, it delivers him from bewilderment. Otherwise, there is no way that Arjuna could actually be delivered from his bewilderment without Krishna doing this. And in the same way, sometimes Krishna shows his hard side to us,
to, you know, people in general, sometimes in a very big way, sometimes mild ways, but we have to understand that Krishna is doing that while he's also being as soft as a rose. In other words, it is because he loves us that he's offering the least chastisement he can to get the result, so that we get the greatest benefit because he loves us so much. That is, you know, the soft side. Not that because I'm God, I can do anything I want. Yeah, slap this little nation around, you know, here's a tidal wave like that. It's not like that, which is what people think. So, these terms here, Arjuna, of course, he thinks that, you know, he's speaking all these words of compassion and what have you, that he's going to be eulogized by Krishna. Oh, you know, I've never heard such, you know, soft-hearted, you know, saintly person as you, Arjuna. You know, I didn't know you had that side of you, you know. But instead, you know, Krishna hasn't done that. And, you know, so that's true friendship. Actually, you know, it's very hard to be friends with people these days because, you know, previously if you had a friend, I remember when I was about that big, and I had a friend who came to school and he had terrible BO. I mean, you know, really, really bad. He came from a very, very poor family. And I said to my father, you know, I said, this boy, you know, I said, could he know, you know? And my father told me that he probably doesn't know, because when you have really bad BO, that you don't know everyone else, you know, the whole classroom, he gets smelled. So I said, what do I do, because he's my best friend? And my father said, well, if you're actually his friend, you tell him, so that he'll actually, you know, solve the problem and it won't be an embarrassing situation for him. Otherwise, everyone's going to think, who's that stinky little kid, you know? Just a laughing, you know. So, you know, in that sense, you know, it is like that. That is the friendship that sometimes you actually have to say. So Krishna is doing that with Arjuna. Your philosophy stinks, Arjuna. Like that. So Arjuna's thinking, you know, I'm going to be eulogized for this, you know, wonderful philosophy I've presented. But Krishna has actually said no. It stinks. So, also here, in this verse, we have discussed Bhagavan, and this is a very important point, because Krishna is beginning to speak here, Sri Bhagavan Vacha. So, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Vyasadeva, so, although Sanjaya is speaking, you know, Sanjaya said, and he's speaking to Dhritarashtra. Actually, the book was written by Vyasadeva, so it's actually Vyasadeva who's writing this. So Vyasadeva, you know, he says, Arjuna said this, Sanjaya said this, Dhritarashtra said this, but when it comes to Krishna, Bhagavan said this. He makes a very clear distinction. Yeah? Very, very clear distinction that Bhagavan. Oh, why are you calling Krishna Bhagavan? Because what is the definition of Bhagavan? Bhagavan is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the highest picture, there are three different levels of understanding, three different features, actually, of the Absolute Truth. There is the impersonal conception, the, you know, Brahma Jyoti, the all-pervading spiritual energy. There is the localized feature of God, the super soul sitting within the heart, and then there's the original Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, who is a person, because you can't possess, he possesses, Bhagavan means he possesses six opulences in full. What are those opulences? We have strength,
fame.
Let's see if you get it. Strength, fame, go on, feed you.
Wealth, yeah.
Beauty. I think it's a beauty, yeah. Yeah, strength, fame, beauty.
Yes.
What's that?
Knowledge,
yes.
Pronunciation.
Fame, did we say that?
Yeah.
Okay. We always do this. Anyway, the six of them, right?
Yeah.
So, we all know that. So, to have those, you know, how can you not be a person to have those opulences? Besides that, as Vyasadeva is pointing out, Krishna said, how can you not be a person and yet you're speaking, you know, the Bhagavad Gita to your friend? How can you have a friend? You know, so Krishna is the person, but that person, Bhagavan, is the, as confirmed in the Vedic scriptures, is the origin of all other incarnations, which manifest the qualities of the Absolute Truth to different degrees, but only Krishna manifests them fully. Therefore, I'll ask you this question. Sometimes people like Narada Muni are addressed as Bhagavan. So can you explain to me why that happens? What is the significance? How that doesn't contradict, you know, what we've just said there.
Yeah.
I would compare it to like that. Krishna is, for example, the rich man. And if someone is his son, they will tell him, if you are rich as well, although the father is rich, but because he's with his father, he might count on that money, on this quality.
That's right. There's pattern. There's a little extension to that, but that's heading towards the point. Yes, there's a little bit more. Yes, that's it. Yes. Because in one sense, we are Bhagavan because we are part of Bhagavan. But we have tiny little qualities of Bhagavan. So if you address someone as, like Narada Muni, as Bhagavan, it is acknowledging that they have these, they are displaying, you know, these six opulences very wonderfully, to a degree, because they are also representing Bhagavan by being part and parcel of Bhagavan. But, so, again, now, the Aryan society, which is basically Vedic society based on Varna Ashram, four Varnas, four Ashrams. The Varnas, Brahmana, the intellectual class, Kshatriyas, the administrative warrior class, Vaishyas, mercantile, producers of the needs of society, and Sudras make up 90%. They don't really have those qualifications, therefore they serve the higher, those who have those qualifications. Sudras are dependent, the other three are actually independent. So, then you have Brahmachari. Think for a moment. Yeah, Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, and Sannyasi. They're the four spiritual orders of life: celibate, student, married life, retired life, complete dedication, complete renunciation. Each and every one of them has a duty based upon this concept that the Aryan society. And this is, again, one of the questions that you probably ask, what is, you know, what do we mean by the term Aryan? Aryan, of course, it means those who, one, know the value of human life, and two, knowing that they are, you know, their goal is spiritual realization, spiritual, you know, they have a spiritual goal to understand Brahman, their own spiritual nature, and as we describe the supreme Brahman, Parabrahman, known as Bhagavan, you know, Paramatma and Brahman. So in order to achieve that goal and utilize fully Otherwise, if someone doesn't utilize the human form of life, they're a miser because they have something very, very valuable. And if someone who has a huge amount of wealth or a huge amount of strength, in this case Arjun has huge amount of resources of strength and courage, and he's not using them, and therefore he will admit of being miserly. A wealthy person may do that. For some, anyone who has a human form of life and doesn't dedicate it towards that ultimate goal and uses it for a petty purpose, just like the cats and the dogs, is wasting. That's non-human. So, in order to achieve that goal, the Varnashram system is there, and everyone has their duties to perform. And therefore, Arjun is expected to, perform that duty. So, point being that Krishna is saying that, it's not befitting you, as we described, your particular characteristics and heritage, and certainly not befitting one who's part of the Aryan civilization. And therefore, Krishna is addressing Arjuna as impotent. Degrading impotence. That he should be performing this duty, but he cannot perform it. That's the sort of thing that a non-Aryan does. An Aryan will just perform their duty, and that is very commendable. The Brahmanas will do what Brahmanas are supposed to do, the Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Brahmacharyas, everyone does their duty, and in that way they all get the result. Here, Krishna is saying, this impotence, this degrading impotence, there cannot be the result, and really the human form of life is wasted just like the cats and the dogs. This is not very good. So, actually, Prabhupada makes a point here that, as far as devotees are concerned, that, Krishna, he doesn't want to see his devotees as being impotent. Krishna actually likes to see that his devotees are able to do what they're supposed to do. Actually, these verses here, I used to meditate a lot when I used to go out in Sankirtan, which was, sometimes I found it very, very difficult. A little disturbing for the mind, and in one sense, I used to do a lot of sales work, so you're getting money and you're bringing it to the temple, but you sort of, you feel like you'd rather be, eating prasadam and, reading books and, sitting in the sun, but there you are running around in the middle of some, industrial estate, talking to all these people just, day in, day out, after a few hours sleep, and it's very, very difficult sometimes. So I used to meditate on these verses, while I was out there, and I asked one question that you're supposed to answer, what would be in these verses, what would be good for preaching application. I was just thinking of before that I used to preach to myself, I'd be thinking, I've just got to do this duty, otherwise basically I'm just become degraded to an impotent person who just can't do what he's expected to do, and Krishna doesn't like that. I know that, he'd be chastising me. And the devotees just go back, at the end of the day, and you sit down and how'd you go? I just sat in the car all day, how'd you go? I'd be, what are they called? What's the word? Degrading, impotence. So you don't want to, Krishna doesn't like that. So, to please Krishna, it's very good for whatever service we do, that somehow or another, we do that on all different levels. Whether it's raising children, whether it's cooking in the kitchen, whether it's scrubbing the toilet, or whether it's studying the Bhagavad Gita and worshipping the deities, whatever duty it is, Krishna likes that you get it done. And in this case, Arjuna was expected, he's called Parantapa, chastiser of the enemies, he's a Kshatriya, that is his business, you're represented as the Supreme Lord. So we want you to, you know, therefore, Krishna was chastising Arjuna. So,
yes, that's what it is.
That sometimes, as a devotee, again, another very important point about this is that just because we're a devotee doesn't mean that we just walk around in this artificial state of humility and, you know, just whatever happens, that's okay for Buddha. That's, you know, it's Krishna's mercy for Buddha. No, I'm not saying that. And Krishna doesn't want that. If there's something actually needs to be said, something needs to be done, you have to do it. He doesn't want this false show, you know, devotees just walking around and not coming up, or, you know, I'm scared to do anything, I don't want to offend anybody, for Buddha's, you know, like that. We have to put our own, you know, imitation of the advanced devotees aside and actually do what needs to be done. So, that, you know, it's a very important point coming out of this. So, anyway, as we explain, I'll just quickly go through some of the other points because we want to have a little bit of a discussion here. Arjun, maybe someone can just read the translation of text 4 and 5. Yes?
Regarding the unity of the absolute truth,
yes.
I think my understanding was that Sri Prabhupada translates Param Satyam as the absolute truth, or the ultimate reality, or the source from which everything emanates.
Yes.
And I think in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Sri Prabhupada says that Krishna is essential expansion. The Mahavishnu potency, his internal energy and immortal energy together constitute the absolute truth.
Yes.
I don't understand this way. How does it reconcile the three phases of the absolute truth?
Well, you just explained it, that you know, Mahavishnu, the super soul, the living entity, Krishna's energies, they're also part of the absolute truth. And the Supreme Personality of God. So, you know, that is the absolute truth. in other words, when we say the absolute truth, we say we have Bhagavan, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of God, we have the Paramatma, we have the Brahma Jyoti. It's not like they're separate, you know, they come in separate boxes, you know, sort of thing. It is one complete whole, which comprises the absolute truth. At the same time, only one of those features may be revealed to a particular person according to the process and their level of realization. So therefore, it appears that they're different. So the example is, there was a little village and a train was coming into the village. So people heard, oh, there's a train coming into the village. We've never seen a train before. But we know there's a train coming. What is it? So they sent one person out, and you know, he was looking. And he saw in the distance, he saw this light, big light, light on it. So he can't run back to the village. I've seen the train. It's a big light coming, getting bigger, bigger, like expanding. So then, you know, another person who stayed out there a little bit more, he came back. No, actually, I've seen the train. There's a light, you know, there's a carriage, there's a big noise, like this, there's wheels. So he saw, you know, more features. And then gradually the train pulled into the station and they saw, oh, there's all these people, hello, how are you doing? And they, you know, said hello and had a personal relationship. And they said hello to the driver who's driving the train, like that. They're all looking at the same thing, but each one according to their distance or closeness was seeing it as something different. So the absolute truth is complete But we may see the features as something separate or different according to our level of realization. So, now there's more going.
I'm a little confused because we understand the jivatattva and all the energies that come from Krishna.
Yes.
Even after we come to Krishna, Krishna is still complete.
Yes.
So by complete package, do you mean that the eternal soul and all the energies in Krishna are always existing? In that sense, they're all the absolute truth, or Krishna, Swayam Bhagavan, is the absolute truth and.
Yes, they're all the absolute truth because there is nothing, there is nothing apart from the absolute truth. There's not like we've got the absolute truth over here and then over there we've got something else. There is only the absolute truth. There is only that one complete absolute truth which comprises everything, even the voids, which exists in the mind of the Buddhist. But so although there is only one absolute truth, everything is part of that one absolute truth. So therefore, you say, yes, this is part of the absolute truth, I'm part of the absolute truth, you're part of the absolute truth, the sons of demigods, anything you see, any energy, the illusions, the truth, the knowledge, relationships, everything subtle, gross, everything spiritual, material, it is all, yes, that is the absolute truth. Because there is nothing else separate from the absolute truth. So you can say. But, simultaneously, everything is also different from the absolute truth. Because, this here I can write on it, but it is not the source of unlimited universes. It is not the source of unlimited incarnations. So it is only manifesting this, a tiny, insignificant little quality of what comprises the absolute truth. So Krishna, he manifests the complete absolute truth, fully. There is nothing beyond Krishna. And then all the different features of Krishna, will manifest different aspects, very minutely, of the absolute truth. So simultaneously one and different.
So is it saying that everything together comprises the absolute truth?
Yes.
And Krishna alone is also the absolute
yes.
truth. And everything without Krishna is not the absolute truth.
Everything without Krishna is not the absolute truth?
Everything without Bhagavan cannot be the absolute truth.
Yes, that is illusion.
I mean, if we talked about Paramatma without reference to Krishna, then that would not be the answer.
Well, for instance, going back to the train. Someone in illusion may say the train. I didn't see any wheels in the train. So. But the train did have wheels, so it's their illusion. So the absolute truth is a complete whole. See, we can't do that. You're trying to understand it from a material perspective, and that's where you're having the difficulty, because it's simultaneously and inconceivably one and different. If I take this piece of paper and tear it up, which I won't do because it's got some important questions on it, but if I were to do so and throw it around, then you wouldn't be able to get the questions at the end of the class. Right? But Krishna can actually do that. He can become separated into unlimited, separated different parts and parcels and yet still be one. Spiritually, you can do that. Spiritually, one plus one doesn't equal two, it equals the same one. One minus one doesn't equal zero, it still equals one. That's the absolute truth. From the material concept, we cannot ascertain that. But that is the inconceivable spiritual nature of Krishna. Therefore, we can understand, because this, the absolute truth has those qualities,
The absolute truth must be spiritual in nature. Sat Chit Ananda, which is described in the Brahma Samhita. It is not a material thing. When we describe the, see the sciences, that's their mistake. You know, because they're trying to understand everything, the whole one, but they're trying to think it's a material thing. And therefore they can't understand it. Only when you can say, oh, it must be a spiritual thing to have these inconceivable qualities to be everything and at the same time separate. Okay. So that actually proves that the absolute truth is spiritual.
The Paramatma is dependent on Bhagavan.
Yes.
So in that sense, is Paramatma the absolute truth or no? Or simultaneously it isn't?
That is the dependent absolute truth. And Krishna is the independent absolute truth. Therefore, Ishvaraha Parama Krishna. Krishna is the supreme controller. There are many controllers. Each controller has a controller above them, and therefore they're a dependent controller. Only Krishna is the absolute independent controller, and that is stated in the very first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam. That Vyasadeva says that Krishna is, you know, independent. But only he is independent. And you see that. Krishna did whatever he liked. He, you know, people criticize again, we say, you know, Krishna is fighting, you know, enticing Arjuna to fight this battle of Kurukshetra. It's not sinful for Krishna. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Whatever he does is all good. But if we do that, it's sinful. If we say, oh, and people have done that, they've actually read the Bhagavad Gita, the Prabhupada was saying, there's one professor, he read the Bhagavad Gita, and he said, oh, Krishna is inducing people to fight, I will also, you know, fight and induce others to fight. But in his case, it's sinful because he's not the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna danced with the gopis. Not, you know, but when Krishna does it and you analyze, look at it, you can see there is nothing sinful. But if we do that, it is completely sinful. If we even do the same thing that Krishna did, we say, well, God did it, I'll just do the same thing. Surely, that can't be sinful. Yes, it is. But, if we do this, if we do something on behalf of Krishna, it is not. So, he is completely independent. No one else has ever exhibited. Actually, one time, one German scholar, he studied all the different gods of the world. And he concluded that only Krishna could be God. He said, if you look at all the different gods, they're all, you know, still somehow subordinate to someone else, or restricted, or controlled by something. They're not completely independent in some way or another. They're influenced by something. You know, sometimes you see demigods are influenced by illusion. That means there is a higher controlling force, right? And looking, he says that only Krishna, he is dancing with the gopis. Everyone else has some work to do. The demigods are working. Shiva is working. You know, Brahma is working. We are working. You know, everyone is working. Everyone has something to do. What is Krishna doing? He's running through the forest barefoot with the gopis. Because, you know, he has nothing to do. But out of his kindness, he also, you know, sometimes does something, but he doesn't have to. He's the only completely independent. So therefore, yes, in answer to your question, yes, dependent controller to absolute truth. But Krishna is the only independent controller absolute truth. So, we living entities where the tiny part and parcels of the energy of the Absolute Truth. So we're part of the Absolute Truth, but we're controlled by the Ishvaras, the manifestations of the Lord. So we're always, you know, controlled. But different expansions of the Lord, they're controllers. But they're still not completely independent. Only Krishna has that position. So it's a very important distinction. Okay. All right. And if you want more information on that, if you look in the Duri Karambi
Madhurya Karam being. In the first one or two chapters, Vishwanath Chakravarti the core describes in great length exactly what I just said there. So, any other questions? So, actually, I want to have a little question session. So, just one last thing, of course, is that Arjun, he then, admitting himself that he has, he's completely perplexed, he has no idea what he should do, and therefore he surrenders to Krishna as the spiritual master. And this is, again, an extremely pivotal point, very important part of the Bhagavad Gita, is that the very nature of this world is that it creates perplexities. And Arjuna was very qualified. He was actually quite knowledgeable. Although, in this case, because his knowledge was influenced by because he became bewildered by the a momentary weakness of the heart because of his compassion. See, the quality of compassion of Arjuna is the nature of a saintly person. So we're not saying that one shouldn't be compassionate. The problem was he sent it to the wrong address. He misplaced his compassion. He sent his compassion towards the body, neglecting the spiritual perspectives. And therefore, Krishna he rejected his pleas of compassion. Not that, you know, but we see in the very, you know, the 10th verse, 9th and 10th verses of this chapter, Prabhupada is saying in the purport that all these qualities of compassion and, you know, Arjuna's knowledge and detachment and not wanting any, you know, results, they're all, you know, proof that he is a great saintly devotee of the Lord, eligible to accept the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. Right? But, so it's not the compassion, it's the misplacement. It is going into the wrong direction. The same with love. It's not that we shouldn't love, but in the material world, it's generally misdirected. So, Arjuna was very, very qualified with saintly qualities. You know, very, very well educated in character and in the ways of the world, and yet he was completely perplexed. Now we look at our situation. You know, we have so many things going against us. We're certainly not, you know, on a platform like Arjuna. if people like Arjuna, who is the personal associate of the Lord, so qualified in so many ways, you know, the material world will perplex them, then certainly will perplex us. That is the very nature of this material world. Understanding that is crucial to becoming Krishna conscious. If there's no understanding of that nature of the material world, that, you know, this material world will actually cause us troubles, no matter how qualified. We can throw money at this material world, you'll still be perplexed. You can throw communism, democracy, socialism, nationalism, fascism, you can throw that at your problems, you'll still be perplexed. You can throw atomic bombs, you know, you can send, you know, rockets and satellites into space, you'll still be perplexed. You can study everything that's possible to study in, you'll still be perplexed. You can, you know, develop all sorts of, you know, qualities of compassion and humility and what have you. You'll still be perplexed. You can surround yourself with family and friends and well-wishers and important people and, you know, like that. You'll still be perplexed. And therefore Arjuna says, even if I win, you know, a kingdom unrivaled on heaven and earth, still it will not, you know, fix, you know, this problem. So the only situation is to actually approach Krishna or his representative. In this case, of course, Arjuna could directly approach Krishna, but for us, of course, we approach his representative, the spiritual master. The spiritual master must be Krishna conscious. Krishna can solve the problem. You know, you see here, Krishna will solve Arjuna's problems, and Krishna gives, in speaking this Bhagavad Gita, Krishna actually illuminates how to solve every problem on this planet, every problem within the universe. Everything can be solved by application of what Krishna says in this Bhagavad Gita. So, in order to be a guru, then you have to be Krishna conscious. You have to actually understand Krishna and his instructions. Otherwise, how can you be a guru? Right? So therefore, the qualification to be a spiritual master is actually to be Krishna conscious, to be the representative of Krishna. And for that, anyone, you know, man, woman, you know, whatever nationality, whatever your birth, whatever your qualification, doesn't matter. If you actually know the science of Krishna, you can actually become a guru. Everyone in this room can actually become a guru. The qualification is one thing: to know, to be Krishna conscious, and to represent Krishna. Every single person in this room can become a guru. And so, Arjuna surrendered to Krishna. Krishna, of course, was smiling because, you know, he was looking at his friend, you can imagine this, and he's thinking, boy, I'm going to make you eat your words. You know, you're going to be so embarrassed, you know, when you snap out of this illusion. You know how sometimes you see someone's like an illusion, you know, especially, you know, these days people fall in love and all sorts of things, you know, they're the wrong person. Everybody knows it. Ah, don't go without that guy, you know. No, you idiot, what do you see, you know? They're just in complete illusion, and you think, oh, you know, you sort of smile and stuff, you know, and they come up and they say, oh, you know, he's so good and she's so good, like that, and you're sort of smiling. You know, at that sort of, Krishna was smiling, you know, right? Okay, so boy, are you going to get a wake up call? So, but actually, Krishna would have burst out laughing. He actually would have laughed. It was so humorous to see his friend. Aren't you? What are you saying, you know? For you. But, because he's taken the position of a spiritual master, he just let a little smile slide off his lips there. So that brings us to a conclusion there. Any other questions? Perhaps we'll just perhaps I'll ask you a question you can answer. From what we've just said, if we saw, let's take this scenario. We're down the beach. We see someone drowning in the ocean. Very, very, you know, big waves. Big, you know, lip pulling out. We're there on the beach. We're probably the only person that can do something. It's risky. If you go in there, you may die. What would you do? What would you do?
Try to help?
Why? Yeah. In what way? That's compassion, right? That's actually a natural quality of the soul. So yes, you try to help. Now.
Are you wrong?
Yeah. So you go in? Are you a good swimmer?
Yeah.
You are a good swimmer.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Anyone here not a good swimmer? Okay. What would you do? You're not a good swimmer.
I'm not a good swimmer.
Yeah.
I'd probably ring on my mobile.
Okay.
Get somebody there because I'm just
not
well.
Where would you have a mobile? You said, you know,
if I didn't have a mobile. Oh, well, it depends how far out they were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you do then?
Then I probably would try.
Go out?
Yeah.
Really?
No, it depends how far out they were. If I ride out, then I wouldn't. No.
Yeah, well,
no,
they're way out there, these guys.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
way out
there.
No, I wouldn't be able to.
You just did.
No.
Okay, what is everyone
think
about?
I'd probably run for
help. Is it? What do you think of that? Is that a lack of compassion, would you say? Is it, or you know? That's wisdom? Okay, but what about the compassion?
What the vocabulary?
There's some wisdom there, but no compassion, or what are you saying?
No, but it's better I mean, not being mean, but instead of having two persons dying,
because that does happen. Actually, on several occasions I've seen in the news, someone has been drowning, and about three adults. Actually, the strange thing was it was a dog. A dog was drowning. What's that?
What about the bird
in
the tree too?
Oh, yeah, that's right. There was a dog drowning. About, you know, three or four people drowned, including the dog. And we saw this thing the other way down the news. Someone had a cockatoo or something, right? Got up in the tree, but they must have had a wind clipped or something, but they couldn't get it out. It was a buzzard. You know, for some reason they wanted to get it, put it back in the cage. So, the man who owned it, he tried, ended up falling out of a tree. I think he broke his leg or something, his arm, ended up in hospital. Ambulance came and dragged him off. The bird's still up the tree. So then another older neighbour coming up the road, he said, "Oh, I'll help him." He goes up the tree, falls out of the tree and dies. They eventually got the bird, but you know. So, you know, one person is like for the rest of his life slightly maimed, and the other one doesn't have a rest of his life. So, is that what would you say about that sort of compassion? Where people, you know, do you think, you know, as humans we should just do that? Oh, look, I'm going to end up, you know, falling out of a tree, you know, on my head here, but, you know, I've got to be compassionate, so off I go. You know, is that misplaced?
Can I add to it?
Yeah.
What Lama was saying, how, you know, it's got to be a certain bit of wisdom or whatever, but what if that person, so you decide you're not going to go, but what if that person is your loved one?
There you go. Well, that's good. Yeah. What is
the mother?
Your daughter. Okay.
Yeah. Then would you go?
So.
What's that?
What would you do?
Then?
I just think of that because I thought if that was my child,
yeah,
drowning,
yeah,
what would I do?
So
then,
would you?
Yeah, I'd probably.
Even though you thought I'd probably both drown.
Yeah. I probably would, even though half me says, "Well, yeah, that child would need to be out there drowning right now."
Right.
Yeah, I would.
And some wouldn't. I see a few heads shaking, some nodding, some shaking. So some are in agreement.
So there's a part of you out there as well. If it's just loved one, then there's something here for you as well.
Aha. Part of you out there, okay. What if the person wasn't a relative?
Yeah, that's right. Mm.
So, you know, when we introduce that, which is a good point, oh, mate, you know, previously, or maybe I may not, but now it's a relative.
Yeah.
I might just go out there and back off. You see how that bodily conception changed our whole perspective, which is what happened with Arjun. Because we're seeing, we can sometimes see, all of us, you know, particularly me, but on a bodily platform, and that changes the way we think and the way we do things. Krishna, you know, like he was seen from the platform of, you know, they're all spirit souls. So Arjuna's saying, you know, my family, my sons, you know, my friends, my relatives, you know, my side, my army, like that. So he's seeing everything according to what the relationship to his body, but actually, you know, the little ant that's calling down the street, you know, may have been our mother in a life, one life, or, you know, could be our mother in the next life, you know, a few lives down the road. Right? So, for instance, the person that we think is our child, or, you know, that most dearest person to us, in the previous life, we didn't care about them. And when we actually die in this life, in our next life, we'll never think about them again. But we'll have a new set of bodily relationships, and we'll be completely, oh, they're the all in all, and, you know, no one else counts. So, as you can see, that bodily concept, it really, it clouds, you know, we can't really have true compassion, because what we're saying, it limits our compassion to this tiny little bodily relationship, but our compassion, quite often there's something, but for a lot of people there can be nothing beyond that. And that's what Krishna is bringing Arjuna, you know, to this point, that to be really compassionate for all living entities, to actually be on the spiritual platform, which is what Vedic culture is about, the Aryan culture, and to therefore see real religious principles, which are not based on envy. See, envy means we don't realise it, but if we actually, if we ever have this decision that I'd save this person at the risk of my life and not that one, that's envy. There's envy, you know, and that envy just destroys, you know, compassion and equality. So many religious principles are actually, you know, there is still envy within them, unless they're seeing on the platform of Brahman, on the platform of spirit. So basically, Arjuna's whole problem is, as he admitted to Krishna, why he surrendered to Krishna, was that because I didn't see Brahman. You know, he is a miserly man who quits this world like the cats and the dogs with no knowledge of the science of self-realization. Arjuna is saying, because I neglected to see in terms of Brahman, therefore I developed bodily consciousness that created a weakness in the heart, and I could no longer do my duty. And that's exactly what happens to every one of us on a daily basis. We don't see, you know, we don't see things from the spiritual platform. It creates a weakness, a miserly weakness within the heart, right? And then we become degraded and impotent to perform the duties that we're supposed to perform. And therefore, to correct that, Krishna will put Arjuna back onto the spiritual platform. All right, so. We've gone out of time. Just maybe one quick question.
What is the solution of this? To ask that question.
What is the solution of this? The solution of this is what we're discussing next week, up Sunday. And that is to see things from the spiritual platform. If we don't see things from the spiritual platform, we will do what Arjuna did, and that is we will. Because of our miserly mentality and limited vision, we will conjure all sorts of arguments based on sastra, logic, religion, authority, of why we can't do this and why we're going to do that. As soon as we get off that spiritual platform, that's what happens. We'll get so many reasons. Oh, Arjuna's got so many reasons. Oh, I can't because of this. I can't. It's all nonsense. It's just coming from this miserly attitude. And the solution is to get off that bodily platform and onto the spiritual platform. Immediately, the weakness of the heart due to bodily relationships is dissipated. And because that weakness of the heart is gone, you can then perform the duty you're supposed to perform with, you know, properly. And that is the teachings of that. All right, so we'll leave it there. And just, well, we just mentioned the, you'll know the homework for Sunday, is that right? I've already given that. Yeah? Okay. Thursday, Sunday. Any other questions?